All right, well, we are at the time for our first general session of the day. And I'm sorry, second general session of the day. And today we're having the unveiling of the Horizon Report like we do every year. And I wanted to introduce our speaker, Larry Johnson, who will present us with the Horizon Report. And then we're going to have a short video collage of videos from the community on the Horizon technologies. And then we'll have a brief panel interview. So Larry Johnson is the Chief Executive Officer of the New Media Consortium, which is an international consortium of more than 250 world-class universities, colleges, museums, research centers, and technology companies dedicated to using new technologies to inspire, energize, stimulate, and support effective learning and creative expression. He's an acknowledged expert on the effective application of new media in many contexts and has worked extensively to build common ground among museums and universities across North America and in more than a dozen other countries. In his current post, Larry routinely brings visionaries and thought leaders from across the globe together to define and explore new ways of thinking about and using technology and to examine emerging trends and issues. The NMC's annual Horizon Report has become one of the leading tools used by senior executives and universities and museums to set priorities for technology planning. NMC's summits and large-scale projects have helped set the agenda for topics such as visual literacy, learning objects, educational gaming, the future of scholarship, and the new web. Larry, welcome to our session. Come on up.
Thank you, Veronica. You left one important part out, and that is that I was a founding member of NLII, the predecessor of ELI, and I'm very, very proud of that. And so we're here today to talk about the Horizon Report. If we can get the slides up, maybe I need to do this. Let's see. And then maybe I need to pat my head and rub my tummy. See? And you wondered how this technology stuff worked, didn't you? All right, so we have an official hashtag for the project, and I'm going to bookend the presentation with this because you can follow this, and you will never miss a Horizon Report. We publish 12 or 13 a year, including the flagship report, which was released today. But it's also an ongoing conversation about everything Horizon from about 6,000 people around the world. So I wanted to share that with you. And, of course, today we're here to talk about the 2014 report. And I'm really excited about the 2014 report because we have done a major remodel to the Horizon report. It's really a brand new report this year. Something that we've been working on for about 18 months. You want to be careful because this is essentially a day's download of the Horizon Report. And so you want to be careful that you don't rock the boat too much. It has become something that is truly global in scope, and it is, I think, a reflection of all the people's hard work and effort that goes into it. So I want to acknowledge some of that. The first person to work with us on the Horizon Report from ELI was the director at that time, Diana. And she and I were co-PI for a couple of years, and then Julie Little took over ELI, and she was co-PI for a while. Now Malcolm is doing it. We really feel like it's a family effort with a lot of people. And the work has begun to have such renown that I had to redo this slide this morning because I was in London last week, and I was talking with some representatives of the World Bank, and they pitched me, would we'd be interested if the World Bank would co-market the report. And I said, well, I'm remembering. And then, you know, quietly ran off the bank. It's official. They are sponsoring the report this year, and we're going to be doing some more work with them. So I'm kind of pleased about that. There's a bunch of people responsible for that. Some of them, I worked with Malcolm to get him to come up. Would you guys stand over there? This is the Horizon Project research team from the NMC, Samantha Adams and Alex and Michelle and Victoria. And they've been working really hard for, you know, like I say, for 18 months to create this new report. So I brought them to New Orleans. We're going to go out and celebrate tonight. I'd also like, though, to acknowledge everybody that's been on our expert panels, the advisory boards, because that's really where the stuff comes from. So anybody that's been on an advisory board, would you stand up? Go ahead. Come on. Yeah. Yeah. And if you'd like to be in that group, we can make that happen, and I'll tell you how at the end of it. But let me do the parts that I wanted to do, that I've been asked to do here. I'm going to start off with kind of the reason why we have the Horizon Report at all, and it goes back to a quote that was in the Atlantic Monthly that Bill Gibson had, and you've heard this, I'm sure, that the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And essentially, the Horizon Project is an environmental scanning project that looks at business and industry and entertainment to see where technologies are gaining traction and then try to puzzle out how they may play out in education. We look at a lot of technologies all the time, and our team here is constantly scanning reports and research and news from around the globe, hundreds and hundreds of articles every day. Looking for keywords related to these technologies, also consumer sorts of technologies. We follow what we've begun to think of as digital strategies. Of course, social media, we've been following since 2005 when we used to call it social computing. The plumbing stuff behind the internet and interesting things that can be done with big data and visualization. A lot of interesting projects this year that we saw about that. And then we're following a number of what we call enabling technologies that, like electrovibration, which very soon will be bringing field screens, not touch screens, but screens that you literally can feel textures and such, will be coming very, very soon because of electrovibration. So we follow all that basically so you don't have to. This is our 38th edition of the Horizon Report. It's been translated more than 50 times over the last 12 years. And we do, as I mentioned, we do quite a few Horizon Reports. We do five under that title. This one, which was the original one, and the flagship report. Basically, all the other reports build on what we uncover in this one. One with K-12 that also has a rich ELI connection with it. Julie Little brought us Keith Kruger and that idea. We work with museums. We're doing a project this year with the European Union looking at their schools. That will be out in about a month, month and a half. I can tell I'm making you guys nervous. Maybe it's 2 months when it's going to come out. We have a little slack on that one. Latin America we do every year. And then we do a whole bunch of regional and sector-based reports that we call technology outlooks. All in all, we're doing research in 67 countries. That's the Horizon Project. Now, as I said, this year we did some new things, and the key thing about it is that we've always tracked trends and challenges, but we haven't really put much, we just listed them out. We would vote on them and rank order them, and we didn't really do much with them. But then this year we began thinking about, you know, what are the essential differences between trends? And I'll tell you what made us think about this very powerfully were MOOCs, because they just, boom, they were just here. You know, like one day they weren't on the radar at all, and the next day everybody's talking about it. It's a really fast-moving trend that a lot of people felt, wow, we really need to react to it right now. That seemed to be a dimension that was really important to understand about a trend. and then really slow trends that are building momentum, and maybe we don't really know what their final form is going to look like, but we begin to think about our trends and chart them into these dimensions. And then we wanted to explore essentially three parts about them. And I'll leave you to to read those, but we profile six trends in the report, two fast ones, two midterm ones, and two slow trends that I think you'd be very interested in. We also wanted to come up with a new way to think about the challenges. And about 2 years ago, Malcolm did his fantastic presentation at the Horizon 10th Anniversary Retreat, where he talked about wicked challenges. And that presentation and the whole conversation around it has resonated with us for a long time. And so we began thinking about how could we categorize other sorts of challenges. And so we've come up with some that we're working with. And the basic notion is that we're looking at two dimensions. And I recognize there are many more dimensions of challenges, but we're looking at two. And one is this challenge solvable? I mean, do we collectively, as a society, know how to solve this challenge? Do we understand the challenge? You know, we can't really solve it if we don't understand it. But we decided that some challenges were, in fact, both well understood and solutions did exist, and all we lacked was the will to do this. And we keep hearing about teacher education and things like that. Well, we know what to do about that. We just need to do it. And we thought if we were to point it out that in fact this is doable, that would be helpful. Then we also layered the policy, leadership, and practice on all of these. When we went to the second category, we didn't do another time-based one. We thought, well, what if there was a category of challenges that were pretty well understood in terms of the scope of the challenge and what might be done, but we didn't really know how to solve it. And so we put this little graph here where, you know, it's solid color on the understandable dimension, but it's a little fuzzy on the solvable. And again, we looked at these three dimensions. And then the final category, the box is empty. We don't understand it, and we don't know how to solve it. And that fits the definition of wicked challenges. And there were some pretty interesting ones that we wrote up in those, and so I'm going to refer those to you. In each case, what's new in our discussion of these is that we're not just talking about projects and practices, but policy and leadership in these terms as well, because we began to realize, wow, if a challenge is solvable, that's a policy challenge now. We just need to make it happen. Of course, we still look at the technologies, and we start with our big list, and the experts always add to it. This year, this was the semi-finalist list, and we do this format for all the reports. Here's one. This is a very dense slide, but it's essentially all of learning on one slide. The left-hand column is K-12, the most recent K-12 report. The middle is the report that's released today, and the right hand is the most recent museum report. So it goes back about 6 months in here. And you notice that every sector of learning is looking at bring your own device. I think that's fascinating. Higher ed's looking at it. Schools are all over it these days, and not just in the developed world. Online learning, more and more important. Lots of overlap in here and some of the things that people are looking at, but also some interesting sorts of differences. Learning analytics, much further along in higher education. Just did a paper on learning analytics, and the real challenge for K-12 is there's not enough data to do big data yet. You know, and so it's much harder to think about it in those terms than it is if you're thinking about MOOCs or online learning. There's lots of data there. So I'm going to leave space here so that we can have our conversation and just go back to Bill Gibson a little bit. This is what the report's about. We couldn't do it without all of you. Your stories are embedded in the report. The videos that we're about to see There are links embedded throughout the report to actual real projects, real policies, real leadership initiatives that are going on in your institutions. That's one of the big collaborations between ELI and NMC, is that all the members have a chance to do that. We'd love for you to jump in and be part of the project. So if you'd like to be on the advisory board, we have a process. You can go to go.nmc/horizon-nominate and just nominate yourself, and that's how you get on. About a third of the seats open up every year. It's not a cabal or a closed group or an old gals club. It's really open, and we are always looking for people that are eager to jump in. And this is not an ad, it's an offer. The Horizon News app, which is in both iOS and Android, is free these days. We are giving it away, and what do you know, the numbers went way up when we made it free. And so we encourage you to download it. You'll never miss a Horizon report if you do. You have access to all of our database of news and research and reports. You get every week the top 10 news stories that we find in our research, and it has a link to every Horizon report ever published, every translation, every edition, and it's absolutely free. So, or just follow this. So, thank you.
So we wanted to kick off the session with showing you a collage of a video that we put together. A few weeks ago, we put out a call to the teaching and learning community and asked them to submit us 2-minute video clips showcasing how they were using in their own environments any of the Horizon technologies. And so what we have for you is the submissions. And like I mentioned earlier, there's an open vote on those projects. And if you go ahead and vote on that, I'll give you the URL in a minute. There's still time to vote, and we'll be announcing the winner at Wednesday's session. Before we show the video clips, I wanted to introduce our panelists. We have some questions that we've prepared to talk about the Horizon report. We have Jennifer Stringer from the University of California, Berkeley, and she is the Associate CIO for Academic Engagement and Director of Educational Technology Services. And we also have Kyle Bowen, who is the newly minted Director of Educational Technology Services at Penn State University. So welcome, and without any further delay, let's go ahead and show the video clip. I guess to kick things off, you got a chance to preview the video. Do you have any comments or any observations from what you think you see from the submissions?
Well, first of all, it doesn't do them justice. So I would encourage everybody to actually go take a look at the full videos and vote for sure, because it is amazing. First of all, the call went out pretty quickly, and so those folks had to pull their videos together in a fairly short amount of time. They did a fantastic job at highlighting, I think, what's going on across the wide range of institutions in terms of showing off some of the cool technologies. I'm a fan of 3D printing, and there's some of that in there too. But there's a bunch of stuff, and I would encourage everybody to go watch the full videos, because that's just a taste.
Yeah, Some of the work being done on quantified self was really interesting as well, and it was. I watched every one, and yeah. it was a really entertaining way to spend 44 minutes or however long it was.
I would really echo that same idea that really the quality of the videos are really what stand out about them. But really, at the same time, they're really beginning to reflect, science fiction as part of learning. Things that we once thought, well, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could, 3D print a Yoda head, as it were. Now we can do that, as it turns out. These kinds of ideas are now,
in chocolate.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, why wouldn't you start with Yoda? And so these kinds of things are now becoming a reality. And so that's what I thought was most interesting about the video submissions. Again, I echo the same idea. If you haven't watched them, I would encourage you to go watch every one of them.
So one of the things that caught my attention in this year's report is this image. I thought it was really interesting. It's an image of the creative classroom model. And it includes several critical elements. It's quite comprehensive. And to me, this represents kind of the ideal learning experience. But how realistic is it really that we'll ever get to that? And what do you think can be done now to begin working toward that? Because it's very comprehensive.
Well, let me give you a little background on it. This is a model that was produced by the Institute for Perspective Technology Studies. It's a unit of the European Commission in Seville. And they really are thinking about this quite comprehensively. And as we began to work with them and to think about how they were using this model, that's why we really started thinking, man, we need to begin to start thinking about things in these terms as well. And we've started with leadership policy and practice, but they take practice into a far deeper realm than we have yet with the report. So I think that we have a lot to mine here. There's eight, they call it a pizza, eight slices, and each slice has a number of really important dimensions. It's a really nice way to think about technology because it makes you go back to what we're doing all this for. It's just very handy that way.
Yeah, I found it humbling. When I looked at this, what came across to me was it screamed partnership, partnership, partnership. It's not just the educational IT, it's not just the academic technologists or instructional technologists, but in order to create an environment like this, you have to partner with the libraries and with your centers for teaching and learning and with your registrar and with the people who support your classrooms if they're not you. And to me, what that spoke of really was the challenge that we have, which is making sure that we're reaching out in partnership across all of the various places in our institution that help to create a model that actually is as comprehensive as that, because it's certainly not us alone that does that.
And I think really what the model begins to reflect is this idea that teaching is very much a team sport, that it requires a lot of different pieces and parts in order for it to be successful. And I think the other part of it is that for people who engage in faculty development, this gives a context for which to begin to put technologies in place. And I think that can become very helpful because it begins to demonstrate the interconnectedness between some of these tools and practices as relates to innovating pedagogy.
So I ask this question every year. If you had to pick just one of the technologies, which of the six developments or technologies, because this year had a slightly different take, do you think has the greatest potential to support learning, and not just learning, but also institutional core challenges? So things that are kind of at the top of the provost list, if you will. Which one of those, if you had to just pick one?
So I'll start this off. I'd say learning analytics points out or jumps right out at me. Analytics is really, it's the money ball of education. The only open question on the potential of learning analytics is who's Brad Pitt going to play when they make a movie about it? Or Angelina Jolie, as the case may be. And so I think that's the exciting part of it, is because it does begin to address so many of the challenges, but at the same time, I don't think it would be unexpected for learning analytics to continue to appear on the report over a long period of time, because as we continue to unpack analytics and all it can do in the different ways that it can fit in, we'll begin to learn more about its complexities, and it will continue to be a part of that horizon and going forward?
So I'm going to go out on a limb. I actually think that the quantified self and the virtual assistants, quite frankly, if we take them to their nth degree when we talk about personalized learning, and we really think about what's going to upend education, to me, this is a space that, like MOOCs, kind of came out of the blue. So there's going to be some, I think, some technology, something that's going to sort of hit us, honestly, from outside of our own space, maybe from the external consumer market, maybe from somewhere else that it's going to be applicable to learning. And I think it's going to come and put the student at the center. And I think that it really is going to put student success at the center, so that what you're thinking of is if students can get information from their analytics and quantify it against what's happening themselves. I do this because, you know, how many of you are wearing one of those wristbands right now? But whatever it is that's tracking our students and their daily behavior, like how frequently they study, whether they log on to the LMS, all of those things that we actually have now, but haven't put it into a package that actually that enables students to really utilize that and leverage it to be successful. And then you turn it in with this idea of a personalized assistant, and I think that it has the potential to change education. And honestly, it might be a little scary for some of the presidents and the folks out there and the chancellors and that kind of thing, because my sense is it's not going to come from within. I think it's going to be disruptive, and I think it could really change the way our students learn and what they expect from us.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And as we scan, you know, the devices that are starting to come out in those spaces, and wearable technology is a piece of this too. I actually think, you know, that it's going to be hard to separate the three of them, kind of like mobile, you know, kind of took on all these dimensions. I think this is also going to do that. And so I think you're absolutely dead on. I would like to comment, though, about the learning analytics, because I also agree with you. You know, this is like my baby, so you can't make me choose, right? Sorry, I like my son and my daughter. But learning analytics, in the conversations that I'm having around the world, and particularly with multinational companies, the organizations that really have the wherewithal to truly make this happen, are all over it. That policymakers in every major part of the world are all over learning analytics right now. There is a ton of focus being put on it. There's lots of really smart scientists working on it, and companies are working with World Bank and UNESCO and OECD and others to begin to assemble these giant data sets that are going to be needed, so that, you know, we're really bringing in a whole bunch of societal data along with the things that are happening in the learning stream. And all of a sudden, it's really starting to, I'm starting to see it. I can imagine it now. A year ago, I thought this was still science fiction. You know, there were some interesting experiments, but it was way far away. But now I really feel like that it may be much closer than we think.
So just to ask a question, a follow-up question to the quantified self, I think there's an assumption in the quantified self that students can view that data, consume it, and do something really meaningful and possibly transform their own experience with it. And Kyle, I know you have a lot of background in this in your earlier role. What are your thoughts about students' ability to really take advantage of that and make it actionable for themselves?
Sure. So I think there's an important piece of this, which is how do you provide insight out of that information? And I liken this very much to, like, you know, when you visit somebody in the hospital, there's that EKG machine that's providing telemetry about things that are happening inside of your body that you cannot see, that your doctor cannot see. And so the same thing happens as part of learning, is that there are things that happen with students, their predilections that they come to the classroom with, their own learning DNA that really we cannot see or cannot immediately understand. And so providing those kinds of insights are very important. But at the same time, it does begin to raise some interesting ethical concerns around, well, if an institution can know something about a student that would make them be more successful, are they obligated to know what that is? These kinds of issues that will have to be explored over a period of time. But the potential is definitely there, and that's where you get into definitely a lot of these technologies dealing with quantifiable information, and how do we draw the insight out of that in such a way that it actually makes a difference on the ground for both the student and the faculty.
I think that brings up a challenge that wasn't labeled as wicked, but I would put it as a wicked challenge in some ways, which is I don't think we're doing enough to do the education part around faculty and students and their data and privacy. And so we're talking about all these wonderful things that we can do with the analytics, and people are more than happy to check the I agree box on just about anything, especially if their faculty member asks them to participate and use Twitter, for example, in the classroom or whatever. But one of the challenges, I think, that we as institutions haven't figured out how to address without being alarmist or without, going to the lawyers right away, is how do we communicate and protect our individual or our students' personal data, faculty data, and what is our role in the national and international conversation around that? And quite frankly, I think that we as institutions have a big role to play, and we need to step up and start engaging in some of that conversation in a way that maybe we haven't in the past. And that's also why I think some of this is going to come out and hit us between the eyes before we know it.
I think the free speech area at Berkeley is a perfect place to start this conversation. It has a long history of engaging with tough ideas like this.
Yeah.
So that's a good segue to the next question. This year's report classifies the challenges, as you all mentioned, into three areas: solvable, difficult, and wicked. So tell us about when that is the most critical for your own organizations, and any thoughts or strategies that you might have to begin to address it.
Well, I was thinking, again, this is one of those things that, for me, the solvable one around faculty readiness and the digital literacy around faculty is fascinating, because I label that as wicked, even though we know it's solvable and we understand it completely, right? And I think that at our institution, we've been having a lot of conversations about raising the bar around enabling faculty to become digitally literate. MOOCs really sort of came out of the blue, and I think that one of the things that it did, which was fantastic, was begin a conversation that we've been having amongst ourselves for years, but not everybody at the institution has, which is, how do we create digital content? How do we integrate it into teaching and learning? How does that impact the student experience in the classroom? How does it impact the kinds of classrooms we build? And in my mind, what we've done with sort of this MOOC conversation and some of the other stuff that seems to be swirling around about our heads is it's refocused a conversation on how do we make our own faculty literate in the simple things that can make a big impact. And so we've been having a lot of conversation about what that would take, and it's going to take a reallocation of resources on the Berkeley campus to make that happen.
I think your observation is really important. And it's important to understand that a solvable challenge may still be very hard.
Yeah.
We may understand it, we may know what to do, but actually getting that done and having the will and the fortitude, to fight those battles or climb those mountains, is a challenge. But the reason why that we moved towards that metaphor was because we thought it would help us to change the conversation we've been having about these things, and that's a very good one, the faculty literacy. Why can't we solve this? Mm-hmm. It's like,
well, at least we can now point to the report and say,
yeah,
it's solvable. We just need to, we just need to put the resources in back.
Yeah, those guys
it.
Said
they
so.
They said it's solvable.
And I think part of it, it's this, that faculty development component is this permanent revolution. It will be infinitely solvable. It is understandable. It is something that can be addressed. But again, in every Olympics or every Summer Olympics, there's a new world record in the 100-meter dash. And so it's the same idea here, is that we will always be striving for an endpoint that we may not actually ever get to. But it'll be, you know, an exciting ride along the way as we continue to kind of figure that out. And I think that's a lot of the value that the Horizon Report provides, is so that as we begin to address those faculty development issues, where's the guide map in terms of how to address that? And then certainly with this model, providing additional framework to work with.
So some of the technologies, as I look at them, point to the support of more individualized learning, more to the person, as opposed to more of the class even or the institution. So when you look at the technologies, which ones do you think might have the potential to build capacity for informal learning, things that students can do when they're not being asked to do, just to promote their own learning and development?
So I think one of the key pieces in there is looking at gamification as part of informal learning. And part of it is that we actually need to begin to compartmentalize informal learning. Because if we just talk about things that are, so what is formal learning then? Is that purely curricular elements? Then what does, you know, what is co-curricular, open curricular, cross-curricular type of elements that involve all of these different aspects? How do those all begin to fit together? And that's where if we look at gaming as a potential solution to that. Now, part of it is that we have to take a broader definition of what is gaming. Because if we look at just kind of the fundamentals of gaming, which is smart choices with intended outcomes, then there are a lot of things that can fit inside of that, and we can begin to recognize those other things. The other challenge that gaming has is that, you know, it suffers from its name doesn't really help it much. So it's hard to get an administrator to support the idea of gaming. And in some ways, you know, MOOCs kind of have the same problem when it sounds like a Dr. Seuss character. So how do you really want to, you know, engage in that too? So that's where some of these are problems that have to be worked through. But really, when we begin to look at how do we legitimize informal learning, gaming, and I think digital badges actually may be one facet of that, that we can begin to look at how does that crystallize and support informal learning.
So these next two questions are sort of related. I'll ask this first one. Given that we are all in very tight budgetary times, how do you go about justifying R&D work on the Horizon technology areas? And what are some of the ways that your organizations have been able to sustain innovation and experimentation with learning technologies?
That's hard. And I was thinking a lot about that because I'm new to Berkeley. I've been there less than a year, and one of the things that we're actually focusing on is refocusing on just getting our services right, quite frankly. And to think about where the innovation piece fits into that, I think you have to look again at those partnerships. At most institutions like ours are looking at the limited resources or even cutting back on resources. So to pull out the resources for innovation means that I think you have to look for the partners who are going to help you. And I don't necessarily mean external partners either. We're looking to research IT and to some of the schools across campus to join and bring resources together for the innovation piece rather than thinking that we can solve that problem on our own or that we're the only ones that are going to be directing resources toward that. So in my mind, it's a conversation, and it's really looking at reallocation of resources across the institution rather than just within our own sort of, you know, educational technologies group.
You know, I think one of the challenges with any new technology is you're placing a bet. You know, you're wagering your time and resources versus the idea that that technology will become something or that it may be effective, and you oftentimes don't want to make that trade because you don't know what that future looks like. You say, well, what if I invest the time and it never materializes? But then you kind of have to ask yourself, well, what if it does materialize and you never invested? So that's really the trick in terms of looking at R&D. In terms of, you know, mechanisms that you can use, and this is one that I've used myself with my own groups, and it's fantastic, and I share it with anyone who's willing to listen, was that we instituted. So Google is famous for their 20% time idea, where employees can use 20% of their time to pursue these kinds of initiatives. Well, the problem is that you never find that 20%. Most people don't have 20% of their time to give. And so on at Purdue, we have the last week of the semester is what our students affectionately call dead week. Many of you probably have a reading week or something like that. But the idea is that they don't have any tests or quizzes or homework, that the week is intended to kind of recharge and prepare themselves for what's next, which is finals. And so in these cases, what we use is we call it our Living Dead Week, where we take everyone on a team, selects a technology and invests in it for a week with the intent of having there being a tangible outcome at the end of the week. And what it does is it sets aside time that is predictable, that people can engage in actively, and it's very easy to set up and execute with a little bit of planning, because essentially to plan it, you're basically planning like everyone's going on vacation for a week. And you can execute that with everyone having outcomes. And what we've seen are the outcomes of that week become the new services that get implemented possibly, you know, as soon as the next semester or shortly thereafter. Like I said, it's worked really well for us, and it's something I always share with people because we just kind of lucked into it as a model.
Yeah, so we have actually designed in the new format the report to be helpful to stuff like that. And if you have a hard copy of it, it actually, the facing pages, if you print it with facing pages, each technology is a left and a right-hand page. It's basically a handout. The report is, you know, remixable. You can rip it up. You can put it with other stuff. It's a great place to start a conversation around some of these things. And, because it is hard. I mean, that's actually the whole rationale for the report is, like, you can't follow everything. You know, what we're trying to figure out is what do we not want to miss? And, you know, I'm just looking at the near-term stuff. You know, the flipped classroom is, that's not a big investment to make that happen. You know, that's really a pedagogical shift. That's the kind of thing that there could be some very interesting things come out of it. I think it's a good illustration of one that's worth the time to have somebody playing with that.
Before I go on to the next question, are there any questions from the audience or from the online audience? It's hard to see if there's anybody at the mic. I don't see anybody. Okay, if you have any questions, though, as we're talking, just come on up and ask your question. So another thought, if you would share with us any research that you all have conducted around the horizon technology areas. I know, Kyle, you've probably done a lot of stuff around learning analytics, but is there anything that you've done or come across in your research that points to evidence of a positive impact on student learning or engagement or something else connected to student success?
So I'm going to pull out one of the, if he's in here. Matt Pastilli is a colleague of mine, and he did research around the connection between the analytic and the actual intervention message that a student gets. So if we can identify a student as being at risk of potentially failing a course, then what is the message that the professor actually sends to that student that closes that loop? And what he did was he researched the science of that message in terms of how long should it be and what kind of language should it use and what's the exact right number of words that you would use to convey that message in such a way that a student may actually heed that message, which was really interesting to me because so often we look at the technology itself in terms of its effectiveness, but in many cases, it's those kind of nuanced pieces of the application that really become the critical point, which is, okay, in this learning analytics scenario, we can identify the students who is at risk, but that means almost nothing if we can't convey to that student in a way that they'll understand what the reality of that situation is. And that was one that just kind of stood out to me because it was very different the typical types of research around learning analytics that we'd normally look at.
To build on that, you have to get them to read the email that the faculty member
That's true.
Actually sends. And as we know, students, or at least I know, as a mother of children in their 20s, they don't read email anymore, even if it's from their institution or that kind of thing. And to build on that, one of the things that we've been doing at Berkeley is looking at improving the student experience by creating an environment that brings in all of the variety of systems that they take a look at every day, not just the learning management system, but everything from the financial aid office to, you know, whatever their Google account is telling them to do and what's on their task list, But making sure that they see the most important things, like that well-written note from their faculty member that says, you're in trouble and you need to come, you know, talk to me, or you need to actually come to class, or whatever it is that the student is at risk. It's, you need to create a space in which they can actually consume that information at the right time. So that's one of the things that we've been doing, and actually it's giving me a great idea around maybe how we can study its impact, so thank you.
So when you look at the technologies, it's pretty clear that there's a big impact on the faculty role, whether it's through the student that is sitting in their audience, or whether it's a technology that they have to learn how to use, or data that's coming from the institution. What is the place for faculty development in these technologies, and how do we support faculty in working with them?
I'll jump in on this. There was a study done by the Institute for Museum and Library Services around informal learning, and they discovered that 88% of your life is spent outside of school, and that once you're out of the formal education system, you've got your PhD or you've gone as far as you're going to go, you don't ever go back to school. Yeah, I mean, you learn some other way. You read, you talk to people that you respect and admire, you get hands-on with it. It's very fascinating to me, you know, how even people that were very successful at school just abandon it, you know, once, and I'm in that group, you know, and I'm not going back to school. And it's not just because I'm too old. It's because I learn better other ways, and I'm thinking that what we need to be understanding as educators is that it's become so easy to learn other ways now that we're in danger of losing some relevance. I'm not saying the university's going to go away. I'm not Chicken Little and the sky's falling, but it's an issue. We need to be thinking about how the world actually works, in times such as the ones we live in, where, you know, social media brings down governments, you know, and helps you keep up with your nieces and nephews, you know. It's an interesting place. And the ivory tower, they has its role, but there's also the role of really reaching people in the space that they're ready to learn.
Yeah, I think faculty development is a tough one. In general, and I think that, you know, everybody sort of knows what works. It's just hard to get it to happen. So we know faculty, I think everybody would nod and say, yes, faculty learn better from other faculty because they, you know, respect what they have to say and that kind of thing. Putting that into practice is not always easy, though. And I think when you talk about what the role is of faculty development, I think we still play a key part in being a catalyst to enable faculty to teach each other. And we also have to figure out how to get the student-faculty relationship to a point where faculty can learn from students on some of this stuff. And that part to me is harder. I don't know how we do that in a way that faculty are open to sort of learning from their students in, you know, that arena, but it seems to me that we're going to have to, because they're the ones that are bringing a lot of these technologies sort of into the classroom with BYODs and all of that kind of stuff, and whether we like it or not, it's, you know, they're bringing it into the space.
Yeah, I think that's all true, and I support everything you said, but it's also essentially a reactive sort of way to look at it. And a longer view might say, we need to put this into PhD programs. We need to put this into master's programs. I mean, in my PhD program and my master's, we didn't spend a minute on anything related to teaching and learning. You know, I mean, not a minute, not any time at all. And I think that's really the core issue here, is that we train chemists and physicists and historians and, you know, literature experts, and all of those people have that expertise, but they're never really taught to how to really distill it and put it into something students can do.
And I think part of our role in terms of faculty development is really telling the faculty story. Mm-hmm. So much of that innovation happens. And it's worthy of sharing, it's worthy of explaining to others. And I think that's a big part of what we can do is help carry that message and make that more discoverable as part of that teaching experience. And I think part of it is that as learning technologists, in many ways, we're kind of the least credible of people, because we're technologists. Of course we think the technology is cool. You know, we put it into place. And yet, you know, so really the best people to tell our story is the faculty. And so I think that really becomes a part of that faculty development role is telling that story.
Okay.
And I come back to the model here, you know, and what you said at the very beginning, it really, it does take everybody, you know, to if we want to get to that visionary place that you referred to, Veronica, we're going to have to work with new team members.
Okay. Well, we are just about at the end of the session. I just want to let everyone know that the report is available for download, and I believe it's a mobile version as well. So I wanted to thank all of the panelists, and with that, we can go ahead and transition to our reception. So thank you.